Welcome to EdPod, Radio National's roundup of education issues. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, Richard Ady here with EdPod. In this edition, a fascinating discussion on the development of the reading brain, how the development of reading has brought radical changes to the functioning of the brain, and what might happen to our brains as reading gives way to digital and visual cultures. Philip Adams from Late Night Live speaks with Mary Ann Wolfe, Professor of Child Development and Director of the Centre for Reading and Language Development at Tufts University in Boston. She's written a book with the intriguing title Proust and the Squid. So what's that got to do with reading?
The title actually represents both a metaphor and an analogy to make the mind work. It's almost intentionally opaque, I have to say, so that the hoped-for reader will have to go below the surface, which is the real message that Proust gave years ago in a very tiny, almost unknown book called On Reading, in which he said that the heart of reading, at the very heart of it, we, the reader, must learn how to go beyond the wisdom of the author to create our own. And so Proust I use as the generative principle that's the apex, the real goal of reading.
Mary Ann, you're a very lovable guest already. I adore you. Now, the squid.
But the squid, the lowly squid. Well, the squid refers to what neuroscientists many years ago in the 1950s and 60s did when they were trying to understand what one huge, long neuron in that squid tentacle could show them about the central nervous system and what happens when a neuron goes awry, what happens in the transmission of information. And so the very long tentacle provided a rich resource. Well, in a somewhat different way, those of us who are studying cognitive processes, and we're called cognitive neuroscientists, we look at processes like reading and math as ways to study the brain in a new way. We are looking at cultural inventions, and reading is an invention. It doesn't exist in us.
I'm getting overexcited already. I've got to calm down here. Now, I love the beginnings of books. For example, you know, the past is a foreign country, or Call Me Ishmael, or Dylan Thomas, to begin at the beginning. And there's another book, I forget what it's called, which says, In the Beginning There Was the Word. Your book begins well. We were never meant to read. What on earth are you talking about?
Ah, yes. We were never born to read. And by that I mean human beings have these very wonderful original structures that are genetically set down. We're endowed to be able to see, to speak, and to think, but we were never endowed by our genetic heritage to read. And really, just to finish that squid, I have to do it. The squid is, to early neuroscientists, the way reading is to contemporary, because if we were never born to read, it means the brain had to learn something new. And so reading teaches us how we learn something that our brain was never, ever programmed to do.
Mary Ann, there's an interesting parallel here. There's a very good arts documentary series being screened on the ABC, the same organization's televisual arm, which points out that it took us almost the first 80,000 of the 100,000 years of humanity to be able to read a picture. You know, pictures come, images come very, very, very late in our history. And then suddenly we could interpret them. Bingo. So reading and interpretation, well, reading images as well as reading words, involves a sudden shift.
It does. It requires a shift. And here's the beauty of all of these symbolic functions. It demands a new arrangement of old parts of our brain. Now, that very essence, the idea that we can take the original parts and make whole new arrangements is the source of our ability to read pictures and to read symbols. And if you think about 80,000 years ago and then think that reading is really only 5,500 years ago,
basically. Yes, it's much more recent than reading images,
isn't it? It's a blink. It's just a blink of our eye.
But why did it happen, Marianne?
In a funny way, I have to say that our first symbolic letters, our characters, were in the service of number. So the first letters are numbers, basically.
I still can't read numbers, Marianne. I can't analyze at all.
The thing about our numbers is that they were in the service of our economy. So if you go back, you really will see that letters were in the service of our first economist.
Well, you could have called the book. You could have called the book "Proust and the Quid," couldn't you? If that's the case.
I never thought of that. I must admit.
That's for the British edition.
That's the cleverest next title of the book.
Yeah. So we started off counting, and we needed symbols for things for counting.
Yeah.
For economic purposes, and they then do a segue, do they, into something alphabetical.
Well, this took about 2,000 years between the Sumerians, who to me are still a miracle. Whether we ultimately find out it was the Sumerians or the Egyptians, it doesn't matter, in the sense that both of those people were doing something miraculous and relatively quickly. But if you think about what happened in between, it took about 2,000 years until we discovered what an alphabet was. And even for your reading public, I just want one moment of the epiphany that represents. People had to understand that their words were constituted of little tiny sounds. And linguists call these sounds phonemes. But if you realize that every word in every language is made up of these sounds, and then the people who were first doing these tiny little proto-alphabets figured out that you could make a symbol for each little sound and be able to represent every word of every language.
Oh, a frisson I'm having now. I am. The hairs on the back of my neck are standing up. This is now, this is great stuff. Now, is it true, though, that when these little things started to develop, and there were quite different forms of notation, the Egyptian being profoundly different, say, than the Chinese, and certainly different than the Roman alphabet, that each of these does different things to the brain, that neuronal connections differ in significant ways.
Yes, this was one of the more interesting aspects when I look back at the history and try to extrapolate from neural images that we have now to what those first early readers had to do. You see quite different uses of the brain. Now, I'll give you just one tiny example from the Chinese reader. Because they are reading so many different characters that are visually so complicated and interesting, you see them using the posterior, the back of their brain, where the visual cortex is. On both sides of their brain, you have so much more activity than you and I do with our alphabet. But you and I use more of the system to analyze the sounds, because an alphabet has that right away that has to get hooked up with vision.
Okay, let me ask you about the oral culture. That would encourage different patterns of brain waving.
Yes, you really see an extraordinary culture, let's say in the Greeks with their oral literacy. And I want to make two points. It is not the case that we're talking about an inferior brain. If you look at Socrates, my heavens, was there a wiser man that ever walked?
He's almost as intelligent as your president, I think.
Oh, we will not go there. I will try my very hardest not to say a political comment.
Three cheers for Socrates. Yes.
But Socrates represented the, you know, the apex of oral culture. But I would suggest to you that we have brain imaging research by some of my Portuguese colleagues in the 20th century, in which they studied two groups of people, one who, very similar villages, but one who were not able to learn to read because of political upheaval and social upheaval. And they studied these two groups of people, and you see the literate brain really functioning in a different way when it handles language. So you do have a reorganized brain when you have acquired this great and wonderful skill.
And in your book, Proust and the Squid, or for the British edition, Proust and the Quid, you reveal that when we try to read in another language, the brain attempts to use the established neuronal pathways first, but then has to learn to make different connections.
Yes, indeed. If we had begun as Chinese readers, we would be approaching our alphabet in the beginning using that already wired up circuit. If you think about an electric circuit, it's like using one kind of electric circuit for a different kind when you go to Europe. And that is a challenge in the beginning. But what is amazing, if you look at the Japanese, you'll see a perfect example in nature. You see them learning a Chinese-like system, which is called kanji, and then you see that same brain being able to use a syllabary, kana, and so that Japanese brain is using two different circuits when it reads by fifth grade. I think it's just extraordinary.
My extraordinary guest is Marianne Wolfe, Professor of Child Development and Director of the Centre for Reading and Language Development at Tufts University in Boston. And this is a little wireless program called LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod. Now, Marianne, the listeners come in two categories. There's the poddies who do podcast downloads and the gladdies, and I can't possibly explain why they're called gladdies. It'd take half an hour. But the gladdies and the poddies are an immensely literate group. Now, as I'd send the program out, we monitor their brain patterns. We can see the brain patterns of all the listeners. But I can't quite work out what's us versus books because they all read like mad. But what I learned from you is that they're likely to have brains that function very differently from that of less expert readers.
Yeah. Well, here is where we are moving in the book from evidence which I have, accumulated all too much evidence for the whole history of how our brain learned to read. And now I found myself, after 7 years writing this book, at a crossroads. We're at a time where, just as Socrates looked at oral culture and saw it as the absolute, the highest point of what he considered Greek civilization to have reached, and then you had Plato and Aristotle who had begun to read, and by Aristotle had read, and it was a new culture.
Mm.
And like Socrates, he said, we will lose precious capacities, particularly memory and how we think about knowledge. Well, I, by the end of the book, had entered the most unexpected place intellectually. I looked at where we have come in acquiring this expert reading brain, and I realized that our children in this new generation are, because our brain is so plastic and can learn to read in different ways, are, for many of them, learning to read in a different way than you and I did. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky. That expert reading brain that you and I have, and I'm sure you're both of your groups of listeners, they are taking that expert reading brain and they are reading on screen in fairly similar, not completely, but fairly similar ways. because their brain is formed. The question that I raise, and it's a very tricky one, is whether or not the young reader who does not necessarily form with the same skills and time involved, whether they are going to form a different brain that is very adept at multitasking and decoding, but
Marian,
not very
probing. This has been going on for many, many years. 40 years ago, I ran an experiment in a cinema in Melbourne. I showed two films side by side on a CinemaScope screen. One was a documentary on Japanese arts and crafts, and the other was a documentary on what used to be called juvenile delinquency, filmed in Montreal. People over 30 got a headache looking at them. Younger people not only followed the two of them quite effortlessly, but noticed correlations or moments of synchronicity. For example, a potter's wheel turning in Kyoto and a steering wheel turning in Montreal. And I remember writing at the time that we're going to have a new sort of literacy, a visual literacy, which would be different. Is that not what has happened?
I do indeed think we are going to have a far more visual literacy with certain advantages and certain disadvantages. And therein lies a tale about which I have no existing evidence. And yet my reader, my hoped for ideal reader, will enter a world of questions. What would and should be preserved about us as this inheritor of this expert reading brain that goes below the surface? And what would be the advantages of this multitasking reader who is absolutely accustomed and inured to the use of continuous partial attention? And I'm wondering and hoping that in the answers that come out of this discourse, we will have reason to believe that multiple literacies are a good thing, but that we must take great care that the more attractive, immediate, voluminous information of the one will not be so strong as to discourage ultimately the kind of comprehension, inferential skills that the expert reading brain till this point easily developed. So I'm a little bit asking, will Socrates' nightmare of people who just decode information well and not really know how to go under the surface of it, will we be reenacting that?
Not for the first time in the last few days. I want to quote a favourite aphorism of mine, that data isn't information, information isn't knowledge, and knowledge isn't wisdom. Your son is dyslexic. I've got a dear friend who has the same problem, who loves to read. You know, I can't think of anyone who reads more books than my dyslexic friend. What does dyslexia tell us about your arguments?
That's a beautiful question. Dyslexia talks to us about the importance of cerebral diversity, a term a friend of mine, another neuroscientist, talks about, and so also does a neurologist who is a fantastic scholar named Norman Geschwin. We have part of our world as the inheritors before literacy of our generals, our artists, our builders, our leaders who thought differently. The research that we have now really indicates that there is no coincidence between the number of great innovative thinkers like Edison and Picasso and Gaudi and dyslexia. It looks very much, and we're on the cusp of understanding this, we're not totally there, that there's in many children a propensity to use a right hemisphere organization for reading. It makes them inefficient, but it does not make it impossible. It means they have to learn differently, and our teaching methods have to be different.
Often they have to struggle to learn, don't they? But they do often triumph. It's harder for them, but when they get through to the other side, they own the knowledge.
Oh, they not only own the knowledge, they go beyond the knowledge. And if there's anything that I've learned from my son, this is a brain that thinks differently. And my son, like your friend, just finished Brothers Karamazov this summer, which was a triumph in our house. He wanted it so desperately. It took him probably three times the time, but he did it, and he probably knows more about it than I do right now.
Marianne, have you introduced him to Proust?
I have introduced him to Proust on audio tape.
Oh, that's cheating. That's cheating. Mind you, I listen to millions of audiobooks as well. Now, so what do we do? We're worried parents. We've got kids who are sort of drifting off into the world of cyberspace. Do we sit them on our lap and read to them? Do we, what do we do to keep that tradition going in this new visual world?
Well, I think one of the real tasks is to think about it very deliberately over development. And I look at parents who are introducing their infants to these Einstein-like tapes that are supposedly increasing the concepts and the language of our children. And I like to give them some of the data that some of my colleagues like Kathy Hirsch-Pasek have shown and others, that language actually is not developing as quickly through those tapes, but that language develops more naturally on the lap of the beloved caretaker, the mother, the father, the grandfather.
I'd like that.
And there are really interesting data that are emerging about how the natural interactions between humans is fostering language development far faster and better than tapes and television.
You know, Marianne, I feel that I've sat on your lap for the last 20 minutes. Thank you. Thank you.
I would enjoy it.
No, you wouldn't. But thank you very much for that. Wonderful. Marianne Wolfe, Professor of Child Development at Tufts University. I love the name of Tufts too. And Director of its Centre for Reading and Language Development. Her book, Proust and the Squid, Okay, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain, is published by HarperCollins, and it's terrific. It's as much fun on the page as I trust it was on the wireless.
Philip Adams enjoying himself there with Professor Marianne Wolfe. And you can find out more about Marianne Wolfe at the EdPod website, abc.net.au/rn/EdPod. I'm Richard Addy. Join me for Life Matters from 9 weekdays on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.